Hello and welcome to episode 2, season 2, 2024 of the NCG Golf Podcast. I am your regular host, Tom Irwin, and I am very pleased that we've made it to Players Week, which means for me at least that despite the rain and the cold, we have made it to the start of another golf season. And it has been another massive week in the golf news cycle. I guess it was always going to be, what with season 2 of Full Swing landing and a PGA Tour signature event going head to head with LIV Hong Kong. We've had the ensuing online outrage comparison. Which is better? Which had more fans? Which had more viewers? Which had the better field? Scheffler's putter got hot, as did Anthony Kim. And this week, as focus moved to Pontevedra, we've had some more quotes from Jay Monahan to stir the pot. We're also fast approaching the start of the new golf season here in the UK. And for many, that means subs renewals are coming up. In season 1, we started to look at a regular look at the price of club golf. And today we will see us extend that conversation, look at the thorny subject of catering at clubs, and not least the price of a subsidised pint. We'll also see the return of Rules Corner and a chance for Steve to cling on to some credibility. Speaking of Steve, how are you?
I'm all right. Now that you've sort of laid the gauntlet down, I might have to up the ante on Rules Corner.
Well, so that's what I'm expecting. I'm expecting some sort of like rule 147.6b in posse question. I think we need to get this out of the way early, Steve, because you've been trying to talk to me about it all week. You had your semi-final of the Winter Foursomes last Friday at the club we do not mention. Were there any plaque-worthy shots?
There were many plaque-worthy shots. However, it was the most dispiriting loss I've ever had, Tom, on a golf course. You shouldn't be laughing, honestly. It's like almost a week. As we record this, it's almost a week later. I still haven't got over it yet.
I don't think I've ever met anyone who swings quite so wildly from massively confident to unbelievably sort of down in the dumps about their golf. Last week, I mean, I think this is a direct quote. Whatever happens, we will definitely give them a game. You didn't give them a game, did you?
No, we very much gave them a game. That was the problem. We very much gave them the game. Shall I go into it? Do you want me to relive this again? I mean,
well, every week we do this, I sort of think, well, this is sort of quite interesting, but you are going on a bit. So can we just have like a version that you think is quite short? And if we need more information, I'll prompt you.
I played Neil and John. John obviously is John Carver, who was Scotland assistant manager. Lovely, lovely guy. Really good bloke. Spent an hour in the clubhouse afterwards, chatting all things football and golf and things like that. Absolutely fantastic guy. To cut to the chase, we were three up. We were dormy with three to play, and we lost four in a row, and we lost on the 19th. It is the single worst golf defeat I've ever had. To be basically like, I missed a short putt on 16 to win. My mate missed a shortish putt on 17 to win. Then our heads completely went. And then on the playoff hole, my mate hit a really nice drive, actually, that just trickled off the fairway down the right-hand side. And I got there and it's wet, obviously. Half the golf course was on the ball and I couldn't clean it. So I hit this 6-iron. I mean, Tom, you have to see it. It just wobbled in the air and just plummeted straight down. It basically just went from side to side and dumped. However, that is not why we got beat. We got beat because we were three up with three to play and we couldn't finish it.
So what you're telling me is that you are Calcavecchia to Carver's Montgomery in the 1993 Ryder Cup at Kiewa.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's very little to say. I think
there's loads to say. Four up with four to play and lost.
Three up with three to play and lost.
I have to pull you up on a technicality as well. You did say you were dormy three. You can't be dormy three in a knockout.
Absolutely. Sorry. Well, as we found out, because we got knocked out.
That is quite a sad story. So what's next then?
Golf-wise, I am...
Is there no like third-place playoff? Do you not go into some sort of plate or something?
No, I don't even think we get a prize. It's just go home, you got knocked out, shake hands, these guys are in the final. It was... We completely dominated the game, Tom, as well.
We've all been there, Steve. I mean, I haven't, but hard luck anyway. So, and in order to play in that game, you missed the sports publication's grand day out, or Woodley, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Fantastic for me. I missed a fun day out to get torched. Brilliant.
Our producer, who is smirking away in the background, took home the bacon.
Again? Because he brought on the bacon with me. The last time we were at Old Woodley, we triumphed in the foursomes by some considerable amount, actually.
It's almost like he's got too many shots, isn't it? Anyway, we won't dwell on that. We played a very interesting format, right, where we had this yellow ball thing going, where you got double points in your team, and the yellow ball passed from one person to another. Unfortunately, two of the groups lost their yellow ball in the first two or three holes. We lost ours on the 12th, and two groups managed to get it round to the end, and that made basically all the difference in terms of VOD's victory, VOD the Pod's victory. You might want to ask me how I played, Steve. Okay, I'll just tell you then.
How did you play, Tom?
Well, it was remarkable, Steve. I shot a 68, and it was about 15 mile an hour wind. It was bloody freezing. I had five birdies, three bogeys, and I was delighted. Absolutely delighted. And I have to say, I'm going to do a shout out here to Joe Feather, who is my new coach, because I haven't had a chance to hit any balls. I've had two or three lessons with him this year, and honestly, it's simple stuff and it's making all the difference. So I probably got the golf bug, hence my good mood. I was driving home on Friday night thinking, I'm such a pathetic human, because for all the things you can have going on in your life, kids' school, kids' sport, money, work, health, whatever else, as long as you're playing well at golf, it's all fine, isn't it?
I was trying to say it on the way back on Friday. It's only a game. It's only a game.
Exactly.
As I did my 2 hour drive down the A1.
But the amount of sort of our own personal sort of happiness we place on it is just absolutely ridiculous, isn't it? Anyway, well, that was good. I enjoyed that.
I've got a proper trip this weekend though, Tom. That'll cheer me up. I'm going to Scotland.
Oh yeah.
North Berwick, Gullen 1, Gullen 3, Dunbar. How's that for 3 days of golf?
Stick that in your 68 and smoke it. That's really good, isn't it? Something in there for everyone, isn't there? Have you been to Dunbar before?
No, first time. I've played North Berwick a couple of times. I've played Gullen 2, but not 1 and 3, so that'll be good. But Dunbar, everyone tells me, is spectacular. And that ends the trip as well. We're playing Dunbar as we come back, so it should be a really fine way to finish.
I have to say that Dunbar's a pretty special place. Not least because you can get the train there, which is sort of a joy in itself. And the golf course is like pretty unique. So I think there are four holes kind of inland on one side of a wall, maybe five. And then the rest of the golf course is on the thinnest strip of land alongside the North Sea that you've ever seen. It's kind of like one or two holes wide at some point. So you're literally right on the ocean's edge. It's lovely and flat. And that bit of it is just sort of classic. Straight out, straight back again. It's brilliant, brilliant place. And it's like home to some proper golfers. It's John Huggins' home club, isn't it?
Is it? I didn't know that.
It's a kind of, if you know sort of place. You'll love it there.
Looking forward to it.
Good. So, come on then. Did you watch any tour golf?
I did not.
You did not?
No. Live Golf was just on at a weird time for me, Hong Kong. So it was basically while I was sleeping, literally, clearly while I was sleeping. I was going to say literally there, but that's the wrong use of the word. The PGA Tour, well, I mean, can I give you an excuse for Sunday? I mean, I was basically grinding some like card tournament for about 7 hours to win about $30, Tom. That's what I was doing. So that's why I missed the golf, because I was concentrating on something else.
It is a remarkable thing. So, I mean, this weekend was like, it was two big events, right? And I guess in terms of the golf news cycle, it was very much LIV versus the PGA Tour, because we had a well-attended LIV event in Hong Kong, and LIV's strength of field is getting better by the week. And then we had one of the PGA Tour's elevated events, a classic venue, classic tournament, the Arnold Palmer at Bay Hill. So it was kind of a good measure, I guess, of where the viewer is at. What I find peculiar is that I didn't watch anything either. And that wasn't because I'm kind of like on some sort of protest about not watching tour golf. It just doesn't feature as part of my life. And it just got me to thinking about how important this narrative is. So we live in this sort of world of the Twitter echo chamber, where every sort of move of tour administrators and tour players and comment of tour players is kind of, we're analysing it to the nth degree, and it's this kind of very binary debate that we talked about before. There's this thing going on at my football club, I don't know if you've been following this story, where there's an influencer called Mark Goldbridge. He runs a fan channel for Man U. Are you aware of his work?
I am aware of his work. Yeah, it's there's a Twitter channel called Out of Context Goldbridge that picks up on my feed all the time.
Yeah, he's a terrible, odious, sort of gassy, blowy, everything that's wrong about the modern world sort of individual. And kind of cynics about him. He's from Nottingham. People think he's actually a Nottingham Forest fan who's just tried to align himself to the club with the biggest fan base. And he's kind of in this online war with Andy Mitten. Are you aware of Andy Mitten?
I am not.
So Andy Mitten is about as credible as a club journalist could get. He's edited the United We Stand fanzine for years and years and years. And he's one of the three or four athletic journalists who cover Man U. He's a dyed-in-the-wool Man U fan. He's been to, hasn't missed a game in God knows how many years. He's got some amazing stories about following Man United home and away. So in many ways, he is kind of like quite a modern journalist in the sense that he is also definitely a fan. Anyway, Goldbridge got given access to Rasmus Højlund, who's our Danish striker. And it was the first time he'd sort of worked with the club on an interview. And apparently some of the players were kind of a bit irked about this because Goldbridge has been pretty critical of nearly all of them on his channel. And Mitten covered it in an article for The Athletic, which was a sort of wider piece about lots of issues. And it was a couple of pars at the end. And Goldbridge has sort of blown it up to be this massive thing about the trad media being too close to the club. And he was just doing his job as a journalist. And why are people so touchy about people speaking to him when he is the voice of the fan, etc., etc.? And it was like a very classic online debate. So between them, I reckon they've got an audience of about 3 million. And my Twitter feed is just full of this debate, right? No one, people can't get enough of it. There's like all of the woke brigade for siding with Mitten, and there's all of Goldbridge's acolytes siding with him. So for a particular part of the world, it is a big deal. But for the vast majority of the world, i.e. you, who is a sports fan and follows football to quite a large degree, it just hasn't penetrated at all, has it? And I wonder how much of that is true about the whole LIV Golf, PGA Tour, tour golf in general, in that for loads and loads of golfers, it's just not a thing, is it?
I can't say that I'm a member of a couple of clubs. I can't say it comes up in conversation very often. Sometimes when people find out what I do for a living, they do ask me a LIV question. But generally speaking, I mean, I'm not sure that club golfers are actually that obsessed with tour golf anyway. On the whole, I don't mean that they don't watch it. Of course they do, but it's not like the be all and end all. They're sort of more concentrated in their own games and more worried about what they're doing on the golf course rather than what's happening LIV versus the PGA. But we do live in echo chambers now. I mean, my Twitter feed, X feed, is full of LIV versus the PGA Tour because that's the people who follow me and I follow them. I think we are guilty now of not being able to see the wider picture in actually quite a lot of things, and that we just see what is presented to us, and we believe that is sort of symptomatic of our entire worldview, and it isn't. It's really a really narrow part of it.
Yeah, and I think that is like never more so than this weekend, where Anthony Kim, God bless him, shot 5 or 6 under or whatever in the last round of LIV. And that has been rammed down your throat on social, like it's the most important thing in the world. And what an incredible thing this is, that this guy's had 12 years away from a professional game and he's already shooting scores in the 60. And that, what an amazing comeback. We've had actually a much better comeback on the DP World Tour in Manassero, sort of ex-prodigy of European golf, who has sort of been away from form for almost a decade, who won for the first time at the weekend. That's the real story, isn't it? That's someone who's been grafting away at their golf for a very, very long time and deservedly back in the winner's circle. The whole Anthony Kim story, through no fault of his own, is very much a media narrative. And I think it's that kind of thing where I think you can get swept away with it. We get swept away with it on this podcast, don't we? Where we think we have to talk about it because it's all you see on Twitter. I'm not necessarily sure that you do. There was something interesting about this weekend. Presumably you've heard the story about Scottie Scheffler and his putter.
The putter that Rory McIlroy apparently recommended that he use, the mallet, basically. Yeah. the putter that we all use.
So I think this is a very cool story in terms of the club golfer. So we get told that golf's now just a game of data, don't we? And we had Lou Stagner on last year and it was all about the numbers, and you've got to kind of ignore your instincts to an extent and just go with what the data says. And we kind of live in a world where golf swings are funky because of TrackMan data says that that's the most efficient way to swing it. And this is a guy who is he's kind of Tiger Woods-esque in terms of his tee to green stats. He's like dominated world golf for a couple of years, but his putter in the last 12 months or so has gone cold on him. And you presume that behind, well, we know that behind the scenes, he's kind of working extremely hard on technical aspects of putting, presumably looking at putting stats, everything he can possibly do to get better. And then it turns out that Rory says, why don't you just switch to a mallet, which he did on Friday tea time. So he used his mallet putter for the weekend. And then he obviously went on to win by a big margin. I think he won by 5 shots, like totally dominated the weekend. And his putting stats over the weekend were just absolutely bonkers. So he was first for putting average over the weekend. And he holed 13 one putts in 16 attempts over those 2 days, which is just absolutely crackers. And that, like... All right, so there's lots of evidence to say that mallet putters are what you should be using, particularly as a tour player who is often looking for a kind of very, pendulum motion, and they're trying to kind of limit the impact of mishits. 62% of the top 50 use a mallet putter, so the kind of like the comparison is stark, I think, between that and a blade. But he's done that on a hunch. He's done that on instinct, hasn't he? He's just thought, do you know what? Suck it. I can't use this thing. I'm just going to use this one that I've got in the boot of my car. It's a TaylorMade Spyder. It's a very popular putter, obviously, in that population of people. But I thought there was something reassuring about that, that even the world number one, a guy who sort of has dominated tee to green golf for the last 12 months, he would still kind of think, he's still doing some stuff on instinct, and he's still, there's a bit of an everyman story about that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe it'll convince more club golfers to ditch their blades.
Yeah, well, and then we'd all get better at putting. Mm. My putting was brilliant on Friday, Steve. Have I told you about my golf on Friday? and then before we move on from tour golf, Jay Monahan's been speaking again this week, hasn't he? Again, I find this a peculiar thing. We all know who Jay Monahan is now. Did anyone really in the world of golf know who he was 3 years ago? Probably not. But we're now all very interested in what he's got to say, because he is at the forefront of the negotiations with the PIF, which will hopefully bring golf back together. Got any Jay Monahan views?
I think you're going to say... You're going to say you're sympathetic to him, aren't you?
I'm not. Because he read my notes. Don't steal my thunder.
Well, because I'm not sympathetic to him. So if you want me to reply to what you're going to say first, you probably need to say it first. I'm not sympathetic to him at all. I think he chose this fight. I think that I'm not saying he didn't do due diligence properly, but if he didn't realize that the PIF was basically an endless source of money that could just keep plowing it in and taking all of these players, then he's really, 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 really not done his homework properly. I still think he's belligerent. He was getting asked about, the players is still like pushing out this strongest field in golf card. It's not the strongest field in golf anymore. It's not. It can't say it is. You can't say it's the strongest field of golf when there are two major winners playing on another tour. It's not the strongest field in golf anymore. He picked a fight with them. He invoked some pretty incendiary comments, whether he believed they were true or not. Obviously, he aligned the Saudi PIF with one of America's darkest days, didn't he? And now, obviously, he's realized that basically financially, they can blow him out of the water. So they've hurried this deal with SSG. I'm sure it's a fantastic investment into the PGA Tour. But this all could have been done very differently. And now he's obviously being criticised. He's being asked questions about how many more players will leave, and he's kind of refusing to answer them, pushing out some absolute diatribe about being focused on some questions or whatever. Did you see that bit? I mean, I just thought, just answer the damn question. You know, all of this is by your design. All of this is because you could have picked a way of dealing with them, and you decided to have a full-scale war, and it's backfired, and now you're in full retreat.
Wow. That was just off the top of your head as well, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, am I wrong? I mean, obviously, I accept that there are different views on this, but a lot of the problem between the PGA Tour and LIV, in my opinion, is because of the way Monahan's framed it. He absolutely went into battle with them. And then if that's the way that you're going to go with it, fine, stick with it. But now he's realised he can't, so he's backtracking. There's an argument, isn't there, that Rory got absolutely hung out to dry in all of this because he ended up being the sort of like the poster child for the PGA Tour, the guy that was basically doubling down the most on Liv. I mean, like, where's Rory now? Because Rory's having to backtrack as well. So he's in a massively difficult position. It's just a mess.
So I'm going to try and sort of make a counterpoint. I'm going to try and do it in reverse, actually. So I think what you're seeing at the moment is, well, we're still in this hiatus where apparently a deal is still on the table. Meanwhile, the PGA Tour have gone and secured significant multi-billion dollar investment from Fenway, and Liv feels like it's stronger than it ever has been. But we are still negotiating, apparently, but we're kind of in this kind of phony war period. I would say increasingly what is apparent is that this is a US versus the rest of the world position that they're taking. So the PGA Tour has for years and years and years played the vast majority, all of its events basically, in America. They had a kind of ham-fisted attempt with World Golf Championships to move it around the world, but often American players did not want to travel overseas and it eventually sort of died away. I think it sort of has ended completely now after having two events last year. So I think you're now seeing these kind of dyed-in-the-wool, blue-blood US tour pros who are doubling down on their commitment to a US-based tour. And I'm not saying it's like a geopolitical thing, although I think there is a massive element of that in that you are talking predominantly about kind of Republican Americans who are seeing their kind of commercial and corporate dominance of the world being engulfed by the Saudis. And I think to a degree that's being played out within golf. And then I think there's quite a human level where if you're an American tour pro, why would you want to have to go outside America to play your golf when you've been earning millions of dollars on your doorstep all that time? And I think that is now obvious. Like if you think about the main players who are supportive of Monahan, who are backing the tour to the hill, it's Spieth, it's Scheffler, who was very, very outspoken this week. Don't know if you've seen that. It's Justin Thomas. These are collegiate blue blood American golfers. So if you then wind that back to Monahan's kind of original stance when the PIF approached him and he famously didn't take their call and all the rest of it, at the end of the day, he is running a player-led, not-for-profit business. So if that is the view of his players, i.e. we are very happy with the status quo, thank you very much. We are quite happy playing the vast majority of our golf at home for millions of dollars. Obviously, there were some very loud voices who thought they should be earning more money, Mickelson, etc. But if that is the view of the majority of his membership, he's got little or no choice in terms of what his position, the position that he needs to take. Now, I'm not saying that you could say, well, you at least go and talk to them, you at least go and negotiate. But I think that is important context in terms of who he's representing and what the views of his members are, which I think we're only now beginning to see. So I think that is one thing that is overlooked about Monahan's position is that he's just trying to represent the majority of his members.
Yeah, but you also have to educate those members. Listen, I mean, like, I'm taking no joy in the Saudis basically taking over world sport, which is what they seem to be doing. I mean, they're ploughing money everywhere, aren't they? Every single sport they're ploughing money into. I don't like monopolies, and I don't think that it's great for world sport. In the event that we're basically going to be dominated in football, probably dominated in boxing and dominated in other sports. But as you say, he's the leader of a players-led organization. The players have some views, but he also has to be the one saying to them, this could be an unstoppable force for us.
But I think that requires an awful lot of foresight. What I think the conversation we're having here is, what about Jay Monahan's leadership? One of the things he said in his press conference was that he kind of admitted that he could have handled last summer and the announcement of a potential merger better. I have massive, massive respect for someone who is willing to say in public, yeah, I got that wrong. Like it's the type of thing that we ask from our leaders and our politicians all the time, is to say, can you not just say you ballsed it up? It's a very human thing to do. It's a very public thing to do. And I think it's often at that point when they kind of they feel like their position is so undermined, they either have to resign or they're sacked. But I think that is perverse, because when that leader has gone through that mistake and learned from that mistake, that's often when they're strongest, because they kind of understand what they've done wrong and they won't do it wrong in the future.
I'm not sure he is strong. I mean, I think the players have more power than ever. I mean, like if you take, I mean, in the echoed world of my ex, account as an example. I mean, the narrative coming through there is that Jim Monahan's basically just there until he's not there anymore, and that essentially Tiger runs the PGA Tour. Now, obviously, that's a view. It's not necessarily true. But I think the result of this is that actually the players are in a stronger position than ever.
But I think it was ever.
I don't think that's a bad thing.
I think it's a terrible thing, personally. I think some of the nonsense the players come out with, which is like incredibly one-eyed, and I think as fans and as commentators, we always think, oh, they're a tour pro or they're a footballer, so they must be right. But they can't make judgments about their own playing circumstances. It's impossible for them to separate their own requirements from what the game requires.
Makes good copy, though.
It does make good copy, yeah. So I think that, and since the cock-up of last summer, they have then gone and done this deal with Fenway. They are now in a stronger position from a capital point of view and from an investment point of view. And I think they're saying, well, actually, we're now in a stronger negotiating position. That is what they're trying to present.
Still can't compete with the PIF. Doesn't I mean, unless the SSG group are going to put in $600 million for all the top players, they still can't compete with PIF. If Liv want to go out and spend another $500 million on another one of their top 10, top 15 players, they'll get them if they want to. That's the reality, isn't it?
Yeah. All right. Let's move on. Should we move on?
Yeah.
I think we've finished on tour, other than to say that NCG are at the Players this week. Our own Matt Chivers is on site. So do keep an eye on his social output on our website for lots of colour, comment and insight from our man on the ground. The whole world will be focusing on Pontevedra this week. So it's great that we've got someone there and looking forward to reading his stuff myself. Speaking of which, Steve, we are going to be publishing this podcast as the championship gets underway. So can I have a prediction, please?
If he finds his game, he finds his putting boots. Rory likes that course, has won there before. I'd like to think that Rory could compete, even when he seems to be playing badly, he's still up there. He's had a couple of very bad holes this year that have sort of cost him some prominent positions, but he seems to be playing pretty well on the whole. I would normally look at Scheffler there, but with Scheffler having won last week, it's really, really hard to win back-to-back. Not saying that it can't be done, but I in a tournament like that, I never stray too far away from leading principles, because I think it's, if you look at the winners at the Players over the decades, you don't get too many journeymen winning the Players. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but usually the victors are top class, so you can usually look to the top of the market.
I think that's a bloody awful opinion. McIlroy never used to play in the Players back in the day when he was under Chubby's management. They couldn't get him there because he was just moan about the quality of the greens. Right enough, he has won one. I just think the answer to the question is Scheffler, and then the only thing you're having to decide on is by how many.
It's tough to win back-to-back, though.
He's always winning back to back.
He wins in clumps, but okay. Yeah.
All right. Do you want I'll have a fiver with you that Scheffler finishes ahead of McIlroy.
Okay. But if you look at the recent winners, Scheffler, Cameron Smith, Justin Thomas, Rory obviously in 2019, Ricky Fowler going back, Keimer in 2014 was at the top of his game then.
Where were Tiger. You last week with this information when I was doing a quiz about it?
Yeah, you were asking me some very strange questions that you were just trying to get me to look stupid, and you succeeded quite tremendously.
Anyway, all this grumbling slips us seamlessly into Reader's Wines. Reader's Wines is a regular feature and a very lazy pun on a popular 90s magazine feature, Reader's Wives. If you know what that is, go and wash your hands immediately. I've picked it again, Steve, because I've not had anything through from our production team about what is a popular Reader's Wine. So I've been having to spend my morning trawling our Facebook page, which I didn't really enjoy doing. So on Friday, it was International Women's Day. NCG celebrated with a blackout on social media. All of our coverage and all of our social channels was dedicated to the women's game. Our team produced a range of features and comment on the state of women's golf, some celebration, a look at some of the issues that remain, and posed our readers some questions. And it's fair to say, Steve, that our Facebook audience did not like it.
What a surprise.
So here is a flavour of some of the comments that we published on an article on the gender pay gap in tour golf. And you say, what a surprise. I was having this conversation with someone in the pub on Friday. And I think you can basically write these comments verbatim without sort of looking at what they are. Start getting bigger crowds and more TV money will follow. was kind of like a flavour of some of the exceptional economic insight that we were being offered. Women's income is better as a percentage of income than men's. Professional sport is a business. I just think it's amazing to say like these comments sort of miss the point so wildly. And it's just, I don't really get it. Like, why are so many golfers, why do they still not understand what equality is?
I mean, I'm glad we've got so many John Maynard Keynes in our Facebook page. Who knew that for exceptional economic insight, I just had to click open a video about cats. We'll get accused of being woke. I don't care. I really don't care what people say. You're either on the right side of this argument or you're on the wrong side for me. And the right side is a game that's equal for all. And there are still, for all the progress that's been made in golf, there are still some stunning inequalities in our game, particularly at club level. I write about them all the time. And I just think, Tom, that when it comes to stuff like this, you know, you talked earlier on about the echo chamber of social media. And I think when it comes to stuff like this and you see these comments, you just have to delete them and blank them. Because I actually don't think they're representative now of the wider view. I think that society is progressing and changing pretty quickly, actually. And that these people, frankly, who, if you look at their profiles, are of a certain demographic, their time is coming to an end.
One thing I was going to ask you about, knowing that you're a keen handicapist, I thought one of the most interesting things we wrote was Dan's piece about the missed opportunity for WHS in a unified handicap system. So at the moment, we still have the concept of different tee ratings for men and women. And Dan makes the point that if we've moved at the point that we moved to WHS to one rating for all golfers, it would have been to the benefit of everyone. And we kind of like know that some of the arguments and problems that not doing that has created, in that we've got this weird scenario where some tees are rated for men, but they're not rated for women. And it's kind of a separate debate in itself. But all that would have gone away if we'd have just moved to one handicap system for men and women. It would have had a consequence in that women's handicaps in the main would have probably moved up slightly, but it would have brought lots of benefits with it: a simplified system, cheaper to administrate, easy to understand, easy to facilitate mixed golf. And Dan sort of finishes the point piece, and I agree with him, that it would have been a step in the direction of us all just being regarded as golfers as opposed to male golfers and female golfers. I think it's a pretty good point. Is there anything you would like to say as an expert in this topic?
I'm not an expert in the actual complexities of how the system works in terms of... It's a very interesting argument, and I think it's got a lot of merit to it. I'd like to see some more calculations about how it would actually affect the handicaps of men and women if you just moved to one system. I'd particularly be interested to see what it does to low handicap women golfers and how it moves their handicaps up and how many it would move them up by. But it's certain, like, one of the things I will say about WHS is when it was being mooted in sort of 2016, 2017, and then when it was really coming in 2019, one of the things that was continually said to me about WHS was that it was a genderless system. And that we would be able to sort of compete together. And it hasn't quite worked out like that. I mean, obviously there are ways of doing it within the system. But it was, in my view at least, it was presented to us in a different way to the reality. And the reality is that there are still very distinct, obviously, handicaps for men and women and different course ratings depending on how the difficulty is for scratch golfers and how the difficulty is for bogey golfers with the slope. So I'd like to see some more data, but I definitely think it's an argument that's got some merit. And I definitely think that WHS was certainly pushed to us on a similar line.
I think I think the more I think about it, I just think it's a massive own goal. So there's all this conversation about gender-neutral tees and how we should be picking tees based on ability, not gender, which is 100% the right thinking. But the handicap system being different for men and women just doesn't support that. And it doesn't support it because it becomes too complicated. And if you haven't said it's one handicap system, it's very difficult to switch the perception of the front tees not being for women. So I think there's huge validity in what Dan's saying. He's often the voice of clarity in these matters. I think it's something I'd really like to debate with David Kernahan from Scottish Golf when we speak to him in a couple of weeks' time about WHS and try and sort of bottom out what the governing body position on it is, because it just, like, once you kind of start verbalizing it, as the Americans say, it just seems to make an awful lot of sense to me. Anyway, so I think that's our reader's wines. I think, unfortunately, National Women's Day did rather make me think that golf's still got an awful lot to do at all levels to be genuinely equal for all. Although it was an absolute bloody weekend of women's stuff, wasn't it? We had International Women's Day and then bloody Mother's Day on Sunday. And the only thing I got was a full day on the piss at the rugby on Saturday in between. It's like, unbelievable.
Well, I mean, poor you. Just getting a full day to yourself watching one of the most famous victories ever seen.
So before we get into the meat and potatoes of this podcast, which is the cost of club golf section, which is going to see Steve educate us on where our money goes, how much a pint costs, I did want to take a minute to ask you all to subscribe to our podcast. Our numbers are improving week on week, and we're super grateful for your support. It does help our numbers hugely and our profile if you take the time to subscribe. It also means you get pinged as soon as a new episode drops, meaning you're on the pulse of all the big issues in golf. Right. Sales pitch over. Steve, I've done all of the heavy lifting in this podcast. The cost of club golf is very much your bag, and I am very interested in the price of a pint. I think we should start, actually, one of those quizzes. You know, when politicians get stitched up and people say, how much does a pint of milk cost? You should probably ask me how much a pint costs. I drink enough of them. I probably should know.
I was going to say, because I actually don't know how much a price of a pint is at my club. I basically just hand over my card and it comes off. So how much is a pint at Old Woodley Towers?
I don't know. That's my point. Like, this is obviously a hot topic for a lot of people. I'm going to say it's like £4. Is that about right?
I think it depends what you drink. I think it might be a bit more than that.
I exclusively drink pale ale, like Kirkstall Pale or Leeds Blonde.
I play, like, obviously, because I play at two different places, the price is very, very different at the two places. So at the club that shall not be named, which is a bit more fancy in terms of how it's service provision and the restaurant that is the clubhouse, I think it's a little bit more. Neck oil costs a lot of money anyway. Have you ever seen it in the supermarket? It's about £8.50 for a 4-pack.
Yeah, but that's like some weird, like, sort of IPA stupid thing, isn't it?
This is what we drink at golf clubs now, Tom. No, it's what I drink. It's not what other people drink at golf clubs.
Right, so we don't know how much a pint costs, which is a terrible start to a debate on the price of a pint.
I think it's about, with the discount at my club, I think we can have a Moretti. I think it's between about £4.35 and £4.85. And I think at Close House, the thing that I drink there tends to be a bit more. I think it's about sort of £5.50.
You know, Moretti's like a sort of joke amongst the youth. If you're a Moretti drinker, you get the mickey taken out of you.
I don't care. It tastes all right. And it's on draft. You know, like I'm not, like, when it goes to, I know I've just sort of spoiled this by saying I drink neck oil at the other place, but I'm not, like, as long as it tastes all right, I'm not that bothered. You know, I'm not going to be sitting there sort of sniffing it and twirling it. I just want to get it down the hatch.
Well, yeah. Okay. So all this beer talk is basically a sort of soft landing into a discussion about food and beverage provision at golf clubs, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that other than speed of greens, basically, there's not a lot more triggering for club members. They really want to be able to get a drink or something to eat at all hours of the day. They don't want to pay too much for it, and they want it to be really high quality. And that is a very tough circle for most clubs to square, isn't it?
You're not asking for much, are we? We don't ask for much there, do we? We want it to be great and we want it to be cheap because we're members and we demand a discount.
So what have you found out? Who have you been speaking to?
This is the Price of Club Golf series that I've been doing with GCMA Insights, and obviously he's been across our channels on NCG as well. So I've been talking to a number of people, one of which is industry consultant Kevin Fish, who's really one of the leading industry consultants. He deals with more than 250 golf clubs. He's been through their accounts. He knows exactly he's a very, very good barometer of what the financial position of clubs is. I've also been talking to a number of golf club managers. So one from, I would say, a sort of typical private members club, which is Redditch. I've been talking to Richard Penley Martin at Denham in Buckinghamshire, which you'd say is, you know, sort of more traditional upmarket private members club in the south. I've been obviously talking to membership people at Fox Hills. So I've been trying to get a range of different clubs and different viewpoints. And we're talking to them in various editions over last month and obviously over the next few months. And this time we've talked about food and beverage, and we've talked about where clubs get their money from and how they spend it. So the two kind of link onto each other, but we're obviously going to talk about food and beverage a bit more. So when you think about where clubs get their money from, Kevin told me that between 95 and 98% of a club's gross profit comes from either member subscriptions or visitor green fees. Now, it won't surprise you that those are the two biggest sources of income, because obviously when there are hundreds of members and lots of visitors, they're all paying lots of money. Membership subscription would, we've said before, Tom, is between sort of 50 and 60% of a club's income on its own. It's a really, really big part of it. But that 95 to 98% might be the thing that surprises you. So basically, all of a club's gross profit comes from member subscriptions and visitor green fees. Everything else, and that includes food and beverage, is around the edges stuff, as Kevin would put it, you know, tiny, like between 2 and 5%.
But, I mean, yes, and in some cases, presumably, it's a negative number, no?
Especially in food and beverage. Food and beverage can be an absolute black hole for clubs. There are some figures that Kevin showed me. I'm saying this off the top of my head, but I think he was saying it's like between plus one and minus one, leaning usually towards the minuses. So I asked some of these golf club managers, you know, like, what are the challenges of food and beverage, and, you know, what kind of money are you making for it? And Denham and Richard Penley Martin was a really good example, because he was able to give me all the figures. So their ex-VAT turnover last year on food and beverage was £550,000.
It's a lot of sandwiches, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot of sandwiches and a lot of pints. Do you know what the profit they made was on that turnover of 550,000? They actually did make a profit. But really? How much do you think it? Yeah, but how much do you think it is?
£7,000.
You've read the piece. Very good. Yeah. £7,000 on 550 grand. That's a lot of work, right? For £7,000. That's a lot of work for £7,000. And what Richard was saying, which I don't think many of us have considered, members certainly wouldn't have considered this, is that the price of wages is going up this year. The minimum wage is rising. Obviously, if you're paying staff the living wage, which many clubs do, then that increases as well. So Richard was saying that their profit margin this year will be an awful lot tighter because they've got to factor in a 10% increase with the wage. So obviously, if you know that 10% of your wages are going up and you've got to cover that. Richard was suggesting that to do that, they need to sell another 15,000 worth of products to not lose out. Now, they're renowned actually for their food and beverage. They're renowned for their lunches and they're renowned for their functions. But if they're doing a good job of it, right, they're renowned for doing it. They're a place where people go to eat, where members go to eat, where members support functions, and they've made 7,000 and they consider that to be a really good year. And now they're factoring in a new wage increase into that, which is going to diminish that profit. I mean, that tells you in a few sentences, I think, how difficult a challenge F&B is. And a lot of clubs swerve it, don't they? A lot of clubs don't do F&B by themselves. You know, they bring in an outside franchisee to do it for them. A club I've got at York, franchisee runs the halfway hut and runs the
cooking. We'll get into that in a minute. But so that's the picture at Buckinghamshire. I mean, amazing to me, in Buckinghamshire rather, at Denham. That is amazing to me that they're managing to make money. I didn't really think anybody was making money. So have you got any data or any numbers from anywhere more workaday?
Yeah, so I talked to obviously Kerry Allen Smith at Redditch. She's the GM there, and she was talking to me in figures about some of the cost increases that they've had this year. So she obviously reiterated the minimum wage increase. But she also talked about some of the costs. So I'll just read out some of these to you because I think they're really, really interesting. She said food costs had increased last year between 10 and 25%. She said they were looking for 60% GP, but the demand from members meant that was becoming more challenging. They'd seen an increase in the on-bar cost of sale. And some clubs saw that go up by 17%, Tom, in 2023. And what the point she was making is that members have to understand the impact of costs for providing a service at clubs, and the GP margin still needs to take consideration costs outside of buying in stock. So she said, you know, everything from employing staff to make food, serve the food, clean the plates is all adding costs outside of buying that cost. And yet members have a real expectation on quality, didn't they? And that obviously can't always be met with value.
It's that expectation point, I think. The rising cost thing is like real, isn't it, for everybody? The cost of everything is going up, minimum wage, cost of fuel, blah, blah, blah. But the expectation thing is like the sort of hidden thing in this, I think, in that we all have higher expectations now, don't we? Like we all expect our Wi-Fi to work. We all expect to be able to watch sport whenever we want. We all expect to be able to get exactly the same, exactly the meal we want at the time we want it. So trying to sort of manage that expectation, I think, is not a relatively new thing, but it's a developing thing, particularly for private members clubs. So if you think about the menu at private members clubs, they always have like a special thing, don't they? I always think about the fruitcake and cheese at Ganton, or like a pork pie that a club's become renowned for, whatever it is. And the reason it's renowned for it is because that's all they used to be, right? So your food and beverage offer was from a hatch. Like think about places like Royal Worthington and Newmarket. They haven't even got a bar. They've just got a hole in a wall. Very, very pared down menu. And the reason that a club becomes famous for something like fruitcake and cheese is because back in the day, that's literally all there was 90% of the time. And nowadays, we all kind of want sort of modern British bistro food, don't we? Served to us kind of like with a bit of, what's that freaking ubiquitous green shit that you get on everything? Rocket. Sprinkled on the top. So expectation, I think, is a massive problem. And it's very that. And then I think these days with the sort of bloated middle class, we're all desperate to keep up with the Joneses, aren't we? So we always kind of like looking over the fence and thinking, is our food at my golf club as good as the one next door? And it becomes part of your kind of decision making about where you play. So this kind of like off course expectation thing is like, that is a big problem for clubs, isn't it?
Well, I think it's more simpler than that as well. I mean, particularly at private members clubs, I think it's a bit different at proprietary clubs, particularly those where they have kind of an off-site restaurant that's attached to it, because I think the restaurant is seen much more as part of the business. But I think at private members clubs, where the members understand that they own the club, they are owners of the club, I think they see good but cheap food and drink as their dividend. You know, obviously they can't be given a share of profit. They don't get a profit share at the end of every year. So what do we get back from being an owner? You know, we're obviously asked to pay our subscriptions. We're asked to have increased subscriptions in order to fund things that the clubs want to do. What do we get back from it? Well, we get food and drink at a discount compared to visitors that come in. I certainly think, you know, from when I sit in clubhouses, that people see that as their right. You know, this is our discount because we are a member here. And this is what we get back. This is our return on investment.
Yeah, we don't own the golf clubs, by the way. That is, I think that's a sort of slight misconception, isn't it? That the golf clubs are effectively trusts that own the actual property and the land. You have a kind of an ownership, in inverted commas, over the club element of it. And I think that is a very nice way of putting it, though, that people kind of expect, because they've paid a membership fee and because the club is thriving potentially, that they want something back from that, and kind of discounted food and beverage is one way of offering it. It is a difficult thing to deliver on, though, and that we've sort of said this before, that catering full stop is like a labor of love for people, let alone in a golf club environment where you have to do it cheaply as well.
Well, yeah, let's just take the last few months, right? So we've got at York, we've got a halfway house that's now open all the time. It used to be open, you know, sort of sporadically at weekends. We've now got somebody who's come in, who's taken on that business, and they have committed to having it open every day for certain hours between 9 and 4. Absolutely fantastic, right? Really, really good thing for the club, this. Brilliant. But the club's been shut for 60 days, right? Because of the weather. So nobody's been on the golf course. Halfway house hasn't been available. The club which will have some people in it, but not nearly the number of people in it that would be there when it's open. So not only have you got to factor all of those increased costs, you've also got to counter the variability of the weather into it as well. Because that's going to be massive. But what I'm saying is, Tom, when we say that F&B is a black hole, right? This is partly why it's a black hole, because you've got all these other extraneous factors that impact on the profit margin.
Yeah, but I mean, it is lunacy at the minute. Like, I was at my golf club in middle of February when it was shut. I think it was shut because of snow. I might have got the date wrong. Anyway, I was there and I'd organised actually a meeting of my school governing body, and it was at the golf club, so we wanted to do it off-site. There was literally nobody else there. So we all were there for like 4 hours having our meeting, had a sandwich or whatever and a drink. And there was like three members of staff there. The whole clubhouse was open. We're the only people using it. So there's this kind of like, but and if they'd have rung me up in the morning saying, sorry, you can't come for your meeting because the clubhouse is shut, because the golf course is shut, I'd have been absolutely mad as my ass, because I'd be like, well, I can't use the golf club, at least let me use the clubhouse. So I think that people are paying to be a member of a club and they want the facility to be open when they want to use it. It drives me up the wall when I go to the golf club and I can't get something to eat if I want something to eat, or I can't get a drink if I want a drink. Like, you are joining a club, aren't you? You're not joining a golf course.
Yeah, and the consequences for staff of having some sort of 0 hours thing, and I know some clubs do 0 hours, but the consequences for staff of having this kind of varied working arrangement that depends whether you get paid on whether the club's open or whether the course is open or not is ridiculous. You can't run a business like that.
No. And the answer, Steve?
The answer to food and beverage, I think we just need to be a bit more accepting of what we're offered, not moan about it too much, try and give our clubs a break. They're doing the best job that they can. A lot of clubs do exceptional food and beverage, but just understand that it's not the massive money maker that you think it is. I think some members look at the number of people in the club from day to day when the club's busy, think in their heads a simple calculation about how many pints are being poured, times that by a month, times it by a year, and think the club's swimming in money. But the reality is that food and beverage is massively challenging for golf clubs. It doesn't make a lot of money. Your discount that you're getting actually impacts quite substantially on the profit margin of that particular part of the business. I mean, it's 10% that they could be getting back immediately if you didn't offer that discount. And just be grateful for the hard work that's going in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree. I think it's an interesting position to take, that you think that people should lower their expectations to be more sort of benevolent to their golf clubs. I think that genie's sort of out of the bottle, and you can't sort of reverse history. And there are places that are offering good food and beverage, so people do have options and people do have choice. And they can, of course, just take their food and beverage business elsewhere. So when they finish the round of golf, they can go to a pub around the corner. Yeah. I think, having been in these conversations like constantly with golf club committees, that the answer is like blindingly obvious. Like, you were talking earlier about, oh, you can go down the business of outsourcing and using kind of third-party catering companies, and they can run a separate business out of your golf club. Doesn't work. Like, never seen it work. Just creates problems. Quality goes down. Those people are trying to make money. They've got no interest in being there if there's no people there. So just forget that as a solution, would be my view. I think there's only one answer, and you have to treat it as a cost. You have to say food and
like
beverage.
Like a loss leader.
Yeah, to put food and beverage on in this club to the level that our members expect and level that we're happy with is going to cost us X thousand pounds a year, and you have to budget for it. It's the only answer. And you stop trying to make the books balance on food and beverage. You can't. It's just the same way that you can't make the maths work on bunker renovations or cutting the grass. It just costs money to do that, and that is what your members expect. So you just have to accept that and move on. Members want a good value, always on offer. So the price for the membership and the green fees should subsidise that. And everyone just have to accept it. So I think there probably is some requirement for members to have a slightly different view. And it's, you might have to pay for a slightly higher subs.
What do you think about levies? So I've never seen this because the clubs that I've been at have never charged a bar levy. But there are lots of clubs that do, don't they, where as part of your yearly membership, a certain sum of money is added onto your bar card to be used over a year. And I see very different opinions on this, because there are obviously those who use it, so they're not bothered because they know they'll use it over the year and it just stops them putting money on their card. But there are also those people who don't necessarily go to the golf club after a round every week, who coming towards the end of the year still have money on the levy. What do you think about it? It's controversial, I think.
It's just the same as putting the fees up, but it's just presenting it in a different way. Or Woodley, you pay a locker charge, you pay extra for range balls, you pay a staff tip. I can't remember if you pay a levy or not. I don't think you do for food and beverage. But I think that, I mean, yes, more income from the people who are members of the club and from green fee payers, right enough, because they want a decent food and beverage offer as well. That's the answer. There has to be more money in to provide the service that is expected. It's just as simple as that. Right. That's that one sorted. Should we move on?
Is it my time?
I'm genuinely excited about this. I've never been someone to turn down a challenge. I've been trying to bait you into actually making this sort of tricky. It's definitely time for Rules Corner.
So, Tom, earlier on this week, I gave a rules presentation to members of York's Golf Club. It was fabulous, actually. It's the biggest crowd I've ever played to. There was about, I didn't go around counting up every person in the room, but I'd suggest there was sort of like 60 to 80 there. I felt like a bit of a rock star.
Do you think in the future that you'll be like on some sort of rockumentary and they'll be like talking heads saying stuff like, I was there at York 2024 when he played to a crowd of 80? You'll be saying things like, yeah, those were the days, just me and my car on the road, trying to gain a reputation.
Listen, in the rules presentation sphere, I mean, this is selling stadiums, mate. Yeah, 80 people.
What is that? Can you just explain the sort of vibe at these rules evenings? Like, is it like cheese and wine? What happens?
No, so last night was really, really good. It was the first one I've done where it was actually trailed for weeks beforehand. I mean, like the club put Facebook posts out about it. I like clicked on Facebook and there was my name on a graphic, Rules Night, featuring me.
You're part of the promo. That's absolutely
I was part of the promo, yeah. I was like, you know, when you see those adverts for a sports person's dinner, it was a bit like that. Yeah. So I was genuinely like a little nervous beforehand, but it was a very warm and welcoming crowd yesterday. I mean, obviously I knew a lot of people who were there, but they were genuinely there to learn the rules. And what I really liked about last night in particular is I've done a few of these and you always get some clever git usually who wants to play beat the rules official. So they're asking you all sorts of clarifications and weird subsections of rules. And the problem is if you don't stamp on that, it sort of ruins it for everyone else, the people who are there to sort of just learn. So there's an R&A presentation. There's an R&A club presentation you can do. It lasts about 2 hours. It does sort of the hard spade work for me.
I now can't, like, I can't get this out of my head. I'm thinking of that David Brent thing when he becomes like a motivational speaker. You're all looking at me, you're going, well, yeah, you're a success. You've achieved.
Oh, there's nothing like that.
Were you wearing like a white T-shirt and like a backwards cap? No, you don't. No.
But when we went for the setup, I did change after the setup. I didn't wear a pair of jeans. I could have wore a pair of jeans, I suppose. Brilliant. But I felt it was formal enough to put a pair of trousers on.
And then the kind of thing about someone trying to trip you up, that is very speed awareness course, isn't it? There's always some dick trying to prove how smart they are. It's just shut up, would you, and let us move on.
And it was brilliant last night. There was none of that. It was a really, really good evening. I enjoyed it, and I'm normally nervous speaking in front of people. But this long-winded way of getting to this was the rules presentation that I deliver, that's the club presentation from the R&A, has a quiz in the back of it. That we couldn't get to last night, unfortunately, because we were talking a little bit about WHS as well. But there are a number of questions in there, and they are brilliant for the purpose of Rules Corner. So they are not my questions. If you download the Rules of Golf club presentation from the R&A's website, you can find these questions for yourself. But they are good questions, and we're going to do a couple of them over the next couple of weeks, Tom.
Oh, unfortunately, Steve, we've run out of time, so we'll have to leave it.
You're not getting away from it that easily. So here we go. So here's the question, right? A spider's web is closely attached to a tree and is interfering with your swing. You remove the web and play your shot onto the green. What is the ruling? Is there A, no penalty, B, you get one penalty stroke, or C, you get two penalty strokes?
Christ on a bike. That's niche, isn't it? You ever read Charlotte's Web?
No.
Neil, I'm just going to sort of try and think of some famous webs. Right, okay, here we go. So something relating to burrowing animals. So we've established in a previous podcast that you do get relief from a rabbit hole or a fox hole, whatever, but not from rabbit scrapings or fox scrapings. So this is something that's made by an animal. Would you get relief from like some dog poo or something? I don't know. I'm going to say that you can move the spider's web under no penalty because it's effectively a loose impediment.
Is exactly the answer.
Get in!
Is exactly the answer. A spider's web is a loose impediment, and even though it is attached to another object, it can be removed. So there's no penalty. It is a loose impediment.
God, I can't believe it. If you'd said to 1995 Tom, in 20 years' time, 30 years' time, you'll be over the moon about getting a loose impediment question right in a rules quiz, he wouldn't have believed you. But here I am.
I mean, when you were going down the sort of animal hole route, I was slightly worried for you. But then you pulled it back to loose impediments and moved over the top to victory. It was great stuff.
I loved it. Right, that was brilliant. I enjoyed that chat. It was kind of broad ranging. Felt like we covered a lot of ground. Whilst we've been on air, Steve, are we on air? Well, I guess whilst we've been recording, I've had word from the BBC's Ian Carter that he will be recording with us next week at 9 a.m. on Thursday morning.
That is very exciting news, isn't it?
That is exciting, isn't it? He's currently in Pontevedra at the Players, so he's obviously got some bad jet lag.
See, emailing you from the Players, that is commitment. But isn't it? Like, it's 5 a.m. there.
We're actually WhatsApping. That's how informal our relationship is.
Or 6 a.m.
Yeah. Anyway, that was brilliant. Thank you very much, both of you. I've now got to go and do some governor business. So I will see you both next week. Thanks for listening.
Cheers. Thanks, everyone.